most of the enemy who were in eyeshot. The others scrambled for cover. "Come aboard!" Merrin shouted over the roar of his engine. McKendrick leapt onto the flatbed next to Caffran. Merrin gunned the engine, and they hammered straight at the enemy lines. Firing from the back of his vehicle, Logris, one of McColl's elite scout brigade, realized his driver was losing it. Fulk was crying out, screaming, resisting the hammer of weapons fire. He slewed the bike around, away from the action. "Pull us back around! The war's over there!" Logris bellowed. Fulk said something absurd and gunned the motor of the outrider towards the comparative safety of the convoy circle. Logris climbed forward over the ammo boxes and feeder cables strewn across the back platform of the bike. He came upon the whimpering Fulk from behind and slammed his head sideways into the armor panel of the pilot's door. The bike shuddered to a sidelong halt as Fulk went limp. Logris spat on the driver. "Coward!" he said, then turned back. Enemy troops were scurrying across the cracked dustland towards him. He took out his lasgun and armed it. "Let's go," he said to them, though they couldn't hear. Bragg pulled back from the window and released his finger on the trigger assembly.
"What?"
Tuvant asked.
"Get out,"
Bragg said suddenly.
"You and Maloom, get out of the cab and back onto the trailer."
"Why?"
"Fire patterns."
"What?" Bragg turned and cursed at the Caligulan driver.
"Fire patterns! Fire patterns! They're concentrating their fire on the tractor units. It's the freight they want. If you want to be safe, get into the sections they don't dare shoot at."
Tuvant and Maloom hurried back through the communicating door into the freight section. Bragg wiped his brow. His hand was rich with sweat and soot. Over the Voxlink, he ordered all his crews to do the same.
"The bandits want this cargo, and so, Throne help me, they'll be less sure of shooting at us when we're part of it."
He yanked his autocannons off the sill and dragged them and the ammo boxes out onto the top of the freight unit.
"We're going to die here,"
Tuvant said, looking out from the top of the freight unit at the hundreds of bandit troopers who were advancing on their circle of machines.
"No, we're not,"
Bragg told him.
"You're mad," spat Tuvant. "We're surrounded by them, thousands of them. They'll pick us off, every last man."
Bragg sighed and closed his eyes. The Marauder bombers came low over the ridge, annihilating the enemy with their belly-slung payloads.
"There are bandits hiding out there in the Deadlands. Impossible to target,"
Bragg smiled, repeating what Gaunt had told him.
"Unless there is something to draw them out and unify them. Something like this convoy."
Tuvant looked at the huge ghost in disbelief.
"We were bait?"
"Yes."
"Kick you for using us."
"I'm sorry. It was the Colonel Commissar's idea."
Tuvant sagged down onto the freighter-top walkway. Bragg hunkered next to him. Around them, sheets of incendiary bombs and phosphor fire scorched the hills. The Imperial fighter bombers shattered the air as they went supersonic and crossed the low hills to pull around for another massacre run.
"Tuvant!"
Tuvant looked round at the giant.
"We were bait, but we still have a purpose. We'll get this convoy through. Calpurnia will rejoice, just like I said. It's just the Colonel Commissar."
Tuvant turned, eyes red.
"I'm getting kick-tired of hearing that title."
"His name's Gaunt. A good man. General Thoth ordered him to supervise the relief work here on your world. He knew that couldn't happen all the while the terrorists and bandit clans were out here. So he set a lure of fat, tasty freight trucks bound for Calpurnia."
"Great.
We got them all in one place so that the Navy Air Wing could dispose of them. Be happy, man. We've won a great victory here."
Tuvant looked up at him. His face was pale.
"All I know is I've been used as bait by your Colonel Commissar. You knew that all along."
Bragg sat back against the guardrail, smelling the acid-rich reek of the burning napalm.
"Yes, the bandits aren't working blind, you know. Hive workers in Aurelian are tipping them off as to the movements of supply convoys. Why else do you think the Colonel Commissar put me in charge of this run?"
Tuvant blinked at him, uncertain. Bragg patted his vast chest with huge hands.
"I'm big. I must be stupid. No brain. The sort of, what was it again?
Kick.
Who would drive the convoy into trouble and then circle it in a defensive position for easy pickings? The sort of idiot who was likely to deliver the convoy right into the hands of the bandits."
Are you telling me you are part of the lure too?
The sweet part. The part they couldn't resist. The part the workers on the inside would vox to their bandit friends about. Convoys coming, boys, and there's an idiot in charge. Right? Maloom?
Maloom glared back at them from his place against the rail.
Kick you.
Bragg shook his great head. He held up a data slate.
Friend of mine, Trooper Raglan, comms officer Raglan, who's monitoring your cipher traffic. I've got you here, tipping off your bandit friends as to the time, schedule, makeup, and strength of this convoy. Colonel Commissar Gaunt told me to do it.
Maloom?
Trevant stammered. A compact auto pistol was suddenly in Maloom's hand as he leapt up.
Kick you, guard fifth!
Bragg was up in an instant, shielding Trevant and swinging a massive fist at Maloom. The gun went off. There was a sickening gristle crack of impact. The shot went wild. His face mashed beyond recognition. Llewyn Maloom tumbled off the walkway of the freight unit and was dead before his body snapped on the hard-packed desert 20 meters below. Bragg turned back to Trevant and helped him up. There was blood on his bulky knuckles. Behind them, the sky was washed with heat wash and cinder smog from the bombing runs.
He was a traitor and a coward,
Bragg explained to Trevant.
Colonel Commissar Gaunt told you that, right?
No, I worked that out all by myself. Now, I believe we have a date with Calpurnia Hive.
A rusty dawn split the sky of Amonthax. The air reminded Gaunt of the tall windows at the Schola Progenium back on Ignatius Cardinal, where he had been reared and trained years ago, after his father's death. Smoky, like glass, fading through scattered panels of reds and ochres to the frostier tones of mauve and purple, high above where the stars still twinkled. All it lacked was the lead-edged figure of some champion of the Imperium, some holy saint frozen in an attitude of victory over the piled heads of the slain. For a moment he thought he heard the plain song of the Schola Choir, singing the dawn celebrant as the star Ignatius rose. But he shook himself. He was mistaken. Across the long daybreak shadows that laced the stinking, muddy trench lines, he heard men singing a rougher, more brutal guard anthem as they set their cooking fires and made breakfast. Milo was amongst them, edging the throaty music of the men's husky, dreamy voices with silvery notes from a slender reed pipe. Just as much an offering, just as celebrational for the providence of a new day. Safe delivered from night, Emperor be thanked. Beyond the lines, the unyielding jungles steamed as the heat of the rising sun boiled the damp out of them. Mist coated the dark trees. In that darkness of foliage and water and mud and flies, what miseries awaited the Imperial Guard. Near to him, one man wasn't singing. Major Rawn sat back on a folded bedroll set by the fire before his tent. He was shaving, using a bowl of hot water, a broken mirrored tile, and the razor edge of his silver Tanith knife. He had lathered with a tiny hunk of soap, and Gaunt could hear the scratch of the blade against the bristles of his cheek and throat. The Commissar found himself almost hypnotized by the practiced, meticulous motions, the way Rawn held the skin of his cheek taut with his free hand, as he looked sidelong into the propped mirror, drew the knife in a short scrape, and then rattled it clean in the shallow bowl. A knife against a knife, Gaunt thought. He always saw Rawn's face as a thin dagger, sleek and handsome. A dagger, or a snake, perhaps. Both would be appropriate. Gaunt admired Rawn's abilities, and indeed even his ruthlessness, but there was no love lost. He wondered how many throats had been opened by the knife Rawn now stroked delicately across his own vulnerable flesh. Watching him shave, without so much as a nick, it emphasized the dangerous control of the tall, slender man. Precise, perfect, the tiny difference between a clean shave and killing stroke. And with that knife, in particular. Rawn looked up and caught Gaunt's eye. He made no other sign of recognition and continued with his work. But Gaunt knew how dearly Rawn would love to rattle that blade clean of soap foam and bristles and plunge it into his heart. Or turn into a serpent and bite him. Gaunt turned away. He would always have to watch his back against Rorn. Always. Forever. It was the way of things. Ibram Gaunt had a billion enemies out there. But the bitterest was at his side, amongst his own, waiting for the moment to come where he could make a ghost of Gaunt.
Part 7. Permafrost. There is a valley on Typhon 8 where frozen screams soar at the air, day and night, through eternity. The valley is a glacial cleft, its sheer sides 9 kilometers deep. Where the starlight catches the top flanks, the ancient ice is so white, the eye can only take it briefly. Deeper as it plunges, the ice becomes translucent blue, mauve, then crimson. Algae forms, frozen billions of years before into the rock ice, stain it with their dyes and fluids. It is the wind that screams, shredded and sliced by the razor-edged outcrops of ice along the valley crest, twisted and amplified by the gorge. Typhon 8 is an ice moon, its surface a crust of frozen water, sometimes 100 kilometers deep. Below that, boiling oceans of hydrocarbons pulse with the tidal rhythms of the planetoid's living core. The screaming loud in his ears, Rorn rolled and slipped down a slope of scarlet ice at the bottom of the valley. The piercing wind raked at him, trying to steal his camo cloak. Despite the cloak and his gloves and the insulation of his cold weather fatigues, he was numb and leaden. The feeling, or the lack of feeling, replaced the rawness of an hour before, and was no more welcome. He lay still, fumbling with his lasgun. Ice crystals formed on the metal of the weapon. He could barely hold it. More shots came his way. Rorn had become used to the peculiar sound the impacts made in this place, a wet popping and a sizzle, as superheated rounds punched into ice which melted around them and refroze. Blackened wounds, perfect circles, dotted the red ice sheet around him. He slithered into a deeper depression in the ice scape and held himself low. More shots, low and desperate, one buzzing a hand's breadth over his head. Then silence, or as close to silence as the perpetual screaming would allow. He rolled onto his back and, with his chin on his chest, looked back along the valley the way he had come. There was no sign of anyone or anything, except a crumpled black shape 100 meters behind him that he knew was Trooper Nylat. Dead. They were all dead, and he was the last. He wriggled up and took a sight. The lens of the lasgun spotter was cracked and filmed with ice, ice which had formed from the moisture of his own eye. He pulled back, cursing. A day before, Trooper Malhoun had frozen his eyeball to his sight while spotting for targets on the ice floes. He could still hear the man's screams as they had separated him from his weapon. He fired a triple salvo, blind, wayward, into the dark of the gorge. In answer, a dozen guns opened up on him and blew up an artificial blizzard in the ice dust. Caves. Low, arched, steepled defiles in the ice cliff wall, carved by the slow shift of the crust. Short of breath, and with a shrapnel wound stinging his thigh, Rorn half fell into the nearest and lay on his face until the cold ache of the ice made him roll over. It abruptly seemed breathlessly hot in the cave. Rorn realized that it was because he was suddenly shielded from the slicing wind. Though only a few degrees above zero in the ice cave, out of the wind it felt almost tropical in there. He pulled off his cloak and his gloves and, after a moment, his insulated vest too. He shuddered, damp and too hot. Sweat built up under his insulating garments, trickling like sauna moisture off his back. He checked his leg. There was a hole in his fatigues at mid-thigh, and it looked like he had been burnt by a melter. Then he realized the blood had not clotted on the flesh wound. It had frozen. He snapped the black ice off his flesh and, wincing as the action pinched, looked at the oozing wet gash in his leg. Not for the first time in his military career, and certainly not for the last, he cursed the name of Ibram Gaunt. Rorn reached for his medipouch and pulled it open. He took the flesh clamps out and worked with them as the medic, Dorden, had instructed them all during Foundation training. But the wire clamps were frozen, and his numb fingers managed little more than to ping them off across the floor instead of opening them. It took him an age to extract a needle from the sterile paper packets. He dropped four or five before he grasped one, and then set it between his teeth as he tried to find the loose end of the surgical thread. Finally, it was pinched between unfeeling fingers. He took the needle and tried to thread it. He'd have had more chance making a bullseye on a target 10 kilometers away with a wrong-sighted lasgun. After 20 attempts, he put the needle back between his teeth and tried to twist together the now frayed ends of the thread. Something hit him hard from behind, smashing him headfirst into the snow floor. He lay on his face, phased, slowly becoming aware of the snorting and sniffling behind him. His tongue hurt, and his mouth was full of blood, which drooled out and frosted down into the ice. A big shape was moving behind him. He turned his head slowly and dared to take a look, circumspect, sidelong, as one might do in a mirror whilst shaving. The orc was nearly 3 meters tall and almost as wide. Impossibly large muscles corded its shoulders and arms, and stinking furs swaddled its bulk. Its head was huge, twice the size of a human's, thrust forward and seated on the vast lower jaw. Blackened teeth stuck like chisel blades out of the rotten gums. He couldn't see the eyes. He could smell the reeking breath, the corrosive saliva that spattered and dripped from the half-open mouth. Playing dead, he watched as it toyed with his medipouch, rooting through the contents with hands big enough to break a human throat like a twig. It took out a roll of gauze and bit it, munching and then spitting it out. "It's hungry," thought Rorn, and his guts iced and tightened at the idea. Suddenly, it moved to him, pulling him up by the hair and jerking him back like a puppet, rummaging in his clothing with the other hand for food pouches, rations, munitions. Blood spilled out of Rorn's jerked-open mouth, spattering down his chest. He tried to remain limp, but his left hand crept down towards the knife, sheathed at his waist. The huge orc jerked and twisted him like a sack of bones, sniffing and gurgling behind his ear, hot breath on Rorn's neck, rancid smell in his nose. Rorn found his knife and slid it out. He must have tensed doing so, because the orc froze and then muttered something in its arcane tongue. Rorn moved to swing his knife, but the orc's huge paw was suddenly around his blade hand, crushing it and slamming it into the icy wall beside them. Two slams and Rorn's hand gave up. The Tanith dagger whipped away. The orc roared, a guttural bellow that deafened Rorn and shook his diaphragm. Holding him from behind, it bear-hugged, pulling its arms apart, determined to rip his torso in two. Rorn screamed, fighting futilely at the greater strength, tearing his arms free. He was dead, he knew that. Death was a moment away. Pain made him reach into his mouth to pull at whatever throbbed in his tongue. He found the end of the surgical needle protruding from the flesh of his tongue. He yanked it out. A shockingly long spurt of blood followed it. Then he stabbed back behind his head with a little sliver of metal. The orc screamed and dropped him. Rorn landed, spitting and coughing blood from his pulsing tongue. The orc was flailing around the cave wildly, holding one eye that dribbled with clear fluid and stained ichor. The noise of its rage was deafening in the ice hole. Rorn scrambled for a weapon, but the orc turned and sent him flying across the cave with a flat backhand. Rorn hit the ice wall hard with his shoulders, upside down and horizontal. His shoulder blade cracked, and he dropped to the floor. The orc charged him, one eye half closed and oozing around the stub eye of the surgical needle impaling it. Rorn rolled. His lasgun was on the far side of the cave, but his knife was in reach. His knife. How many fights had he won with that? How many throats had he cut? How many hearts had he burst? How many stomachs had he opened? He reached it, grasped it, turned in a low crouch to meet the attacker, a gleeful look on his face. The orc faced him, its back to the cave mouth, a huge, crude bolt pistol in its ichor-spattered fist. The orc spoke. Slow, rumbling, alien. Rorn didn't know what it said, but he knew what it meant. There was a blinding flash and the roar of a weapon loosed in the confines of the cave. Rorn had always wondered what it would feel like to take the killing hit, to be shot mortally, to die. But there was no feeling, no sense. In the blink of an eye, he saw the orc explode, its midsection disintegrating in a burst of light. It fell, almost in two parts. Its body fluids froze as it flopped to the ground. There was a tall figure in the cave entrance, blocking the light. "Major Rorn." Ibram Gaunt entered the cave and holstered his bolt pistol. It seemed that the Commissar had fared no better than him. The Orc warband had decided to take advantage of the chaos of the Crusade's push to seize Typhon as part of its attempt to build a raiding foothold into the Sabbat worlds. Charged with destroying the menace, the ghosts had deployed into the long gorges and ice flows of the moon and come undone. As Rorn's platoon had been cut down along the eastern edge of the Screaming Valley, so Gaunt's had to the west. In retreat, the Greenskins had proved the more determined adversaries. The Commissar and the Major crouched down in the ice cave together. Rorn had made no sign of gratitude. In many ways, he knew he would rather be dead than remain beholden to the off-worlder. "How's your tongue?" Gaunt asked, getting a fire lit with chemical blocks.
"Why?"
"You're not saying much." Rorn spat. "That's fine. A clean wound with a sharp instrument." Truth was, his swollen tongue felt like a bedroll in his mouth, but he would not let the Commissar have the satisfaction of knowing his discomfort. But he could not disguise the pain his leg gave him. "Let me see to that," Gaunt said. Rorn shook his head. "That was an order," Gaunt sighed. He moved over, pulling his own medipouch open. His clips were frozen too, but he warmed them over the chemical flame and then pinched the lips of Rorn's thigh wound shut. He sprayed the area with antiseptic from the one-use flask. Rorn felt his limb go dead. Then Gaunt warmed his numb fingers and threaded surgical cord into a fresh needle. He handed Rorn his dagger. "Bite the hilt." Rorn did so and stayed silent as Gaunt sewed the torn flesh together. Gaunt bit off the cord and tied it, wrapping a dressing over the wound. Rorn spat the dagger out. Gaunt packed the kit away and then settled a kettle pan over the flames, dropping a scoop of ice into it.
"Seems to me Typhon has leveled us, Major," he said after a while.
"How so?" "The highborn Commissar, with all his airs and graces and rank, his scholar training and his expertise, the low-life Tanith gangster with his wiles and tricks and diversions. It's put us on a level. Equals. Both fighting the same hostility with the same chances." Rorn didn't manage his retort. His tongue was too swollen and sore. He managed to spit again. Gaunt smiled and watched the ice water boil in the pan.
"Good. Maybe not. If you can still spit at me and hold me in contempt, we're not equal. I can lower myself down towards your level to help you. Feth, save you. But the day we're both on a level, your level, I'll kill myself."
"Is that a promise?" Rorn asked. Gaunt laughed. He dropped some dehydrated food cubes into the bubbling pan and stirred them. Dry powdered bean soup puffed and formed. He was still laughing as he poured the soup into two tin cups. The wind rose as night fell. It howled outside the mouth of the cave, raising the volume and intensity of the screaming. They sat together in the dark, watching the fire. There were only four fuel blocks left to feed the blaze, and Gaunt was being careful.
"You want to know some other differences between us, Rorn?"
Rorn wanted to say no, but his tongue was now too swollen and useless. He spat at Gaunt again instead. Gaunt smiled and nodded down at the spittle, freezing on the ice.
"There's one. This place might be a ball of frozen moisture, but you won't see me going around losing body moisture like that. The wind will freeze you dry in a few hours. Conserve your body water. Stop spitting at me and you might live."
He held out a bowl of tepid water to Rorn, and after a moment, the Major took it and drank.
"Here's another. It's warm in here, warmer than outside, but it's still close to zero. You're half stripped and you're shivering."
Gaunt was still dressed in his full uniform, and his cloak was pulled around him. Rorn realized how numb he had become and began to pull his vest and cloak around him again.
"Why?"
the Major asked thickly.
"Why? Because I know. I've fought through cold zones before."
"Not that. Why?" Why would you want to keep me alive?
Gaunt was silent for a while. Good question, he said at last. Given that you'd like nothing better than to see me dead. But I'm a commissar of the Imperial Guard, charged by the Emperor to keep his fighting legions able and intact in the face of battle. I won't let you die. That's my job. That's why I saved you here. That's why I saved the Tanith from the destruction of their world. There was a long silence, broken only by the crackling chemical bricks of the fire.
You know I'll never see it that way,
Rorn said, his voice cold and small.
You left Tanith to die. You didn't let us stand and fight. I will never forgive you that.
Gaunt nodded. I know, then after a moment. I wish it wasn't, sir. Rorn rolled himself up into a cleft of the ice cave and pulled the cloak around him. He felt only one thing. Hate. Somehow, somewhen, dawn had come up. Thin, frail light poked into the cave. Gaunt was asleep, huddled down under his cloak, covered in frost. Rorn slowly got to his feet, fighting the ache in his bones and the almighty cold. The fire had long since gone out. He edged around the cave, staring down at Gaunt. Pain ebbed through his sewn leg, his shoulders, his mouth. The pain cleared the fuzziness of his head and made him sharp. He picked up his Tanith knife, wiped the frost from it, and knelt to place its blade against Gaunt's throat. No one would know. No one would ever find the body. And even if they did. Gaunt shuddered in his sleep. He spoke the name of Tanith twice, as his eyelids rolled and flicked. Then he spoke, curling up on himself.
Well, let them die. No, not all of them. In the name of the Emperor, Sim!
Then his voice died away into mumbling. Rorn's hand tensed on the knife. He hesitated. Gaunt spoke again, his dreaming voice a low monotone.
No, 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 no. It's burning. Burning. I would never.
Never what?
Rorn hissed, about to pull the dagger up in a quick killing slice.
Tanith, in the name of the Emperor!
Rorn twisted where he crouched. He pulled the dagger up, not in a killing slice, but in an arc that threw it across at the mouth of the cave and impaled the throat of the orc creeping inside towards them. As it fell back, gurgling, Rorn heard raucous baying from outside. He kicked Gaunt in the ribs to rouse him and swung up his lasgun, firing wildly at the cave mouth.
They're on us, Gaunt, you bastard! He screamed. They're on us!
8 fierce, wordless minutes, weapons spitting and cracking in their hands. Gaunt roused from deep, troubled sleep to combat readiness with the speed of long experience. 6 orcs had come right up to the mouth of the cave, and without cover could do little but shoot and die. Caught in the mouth of the cave, the 2 Imperial soldiers had better cover and the advantage of the slope. Huge carcasses fell and slid, smoking, down the crimson ice. Rorn dropped the last of them and turned to find Gaunt scanning the valley floor with his scope.
We can't stay here, the commissar said. That exchange will bring them from all around.
We have cover here,
Rorn argued. Gaunt kicked the ice at the cave mouth.
All we have is a tomb. Get enough of them around to pen us in, and they'll bring the ice cliff down and bury us. We have to move, and fast.
They ditched bedrolls and anything else it would take too long to repack. Gaunt prioritized ammo, food, Rorn's small satchel of tube charges, their cold weather gear. In less than a minute, they were fleeing down the slope outside, cloaks flying, into the dawn chill. 12 kilometers away, the steep angles of the rising sun lit the far wall of the valley. But they were in twilight here, a frosty darkness in which the scarlet ice around them glowed and shone like marble. Or meat in a butcher's shop. Distantly, the crump of weapons fire. They hugged the valley wall, using ice rocks as cover as the wind wailed and agonized around them. A kilometer or so from the cave, they rested, sweating in their insulated fabrics, crouched down in the cover of a block splinter fallen from high above. Rorn wiped the orc blood off his knife and cut a hank of cloth from the edge of his stealth cape. He'd lost a glove somewhere, and his hand was aching and raw with the cold. He bound the cloth around his hand, tying it tight like a mitten. Gaunt touched his shoulder and pointed back the way they had come. Lights, big, gleaming lamps, bobbed and bounced along the valley floor. Vehicles. The wind was too loud to make out engine notes. "Come on," said Gaunt. From shelter, a scoop cut in the ice floor, they watched the vehicles pass 500 meters away. Four big orc machines, black and pumping blacker smoke from crude combustion engines. Thick treaded tires with chains gave the front end of the machines traction, and the rear sections were carried on sled runners or tracks. Each vehicle carried at least two other warriors beside the driver, and hefty weapons on pintle or turret mounts. They howled past, spraying up sheets of ice particles, close enough for the men to see the tribal markings on the battered flanks of the machines and smell the stink of their burning oil. Once they had passed, Gaunt made to continue, but Rawn pulled him back. "They know how fast we can run," he said. Sure enough, a roar reached them over the howling wind a minute or so later, and the vehicle sped back past the way they had come, searching back over the ground to see what they had missed. One pulled away west, and two more raced onwards. The fourth curved around in a spray of ice and moved towards them to search along the wall of the valley. They were trapped. They could not run because there was nowhere to run to without exposing themselves to the orcs if they rose from the scoop. Huddled low, they watched. The orc half-sled slowed, and one of the burly warriors jumped down, running alongside the vehicle, firing into caves along the valley wall. The other warrior traversed the heavy weapon of the trundling vehicle from side to side. Closer. Gaunt turned to Rawn and nodded to his lasgun. "More range, better sight. Take the weapons operator, not the driver. If his gunner's dead, all he can do is drive. If he dies, the gunner can still fire. Target the gunner, and when you've got him, re-aim on the foot soldier." Rawn nodded and breathed hard on his sight to warm the lens. He clicked in a fresh energy clip as quietly as he could. Though the wind was screaming, the hard metal clack would carry like a shot. He saw Gaunt carefully doing the same with the sickle pattern magazine of his bolt pistol. The motor sled turned their way, its harsh lights catching the lip of their ice scoop, making the scarlet ice translucent and all the more like fresh meat. Rawn took his aim. He knew he was no marksman like Larkin or Elgith, but he was passable. Even so, he let the sled slip closer in before he felt confident of a shot. His only target, the silhouette of the vehicle behind the lights. Closer. Almost on them. Rawn fired. His blazing shot hit the black shape behind the lights. There was a double flash, and then a series of loud, fierce explosions, like gunshots. The sled veered sideways, bumping to a halt. Rawn realized they had been gunshots. He had hit the gunner squarely, but his shot had passed through the weapon mount on the way, exploding the heavy bolter and igniting the ammo drum. The gunner's smoking corpse hung from the burning weapon and, even as they watched, stray rounds superheated and went off like fireworks. The driver was also dead, the back of his skull and neck riddled with shrapnel from the exploding ammo. Gaunt and Rawn leapt up out of the scoop and ran towards the motorized sled. The orc left on foot was running their way, firing from the hip. Bolt rounds whizzed and sang around them, fizzling into the ice. Yelling as he charged the advancing orc, Rawn fired on full auto, his lasgun bucking as he carried it low against his side. Two laser shots spun the monstrous orc off his feet and dropped him on the ice where he lay twitching. Gaunt reached the sled, screwing up his nose at the smell of burning flesh. The gun and the gunner were still burning, but fire had not spread to the rest of the machine. He stepped forward, but darted back as another round went up. Then it was quiet. He leapt up onto the tailboards and put a point-blank round through the gunner's back, though he was sure the orc was dead. He had heard too many tales of the greenskin resilience to injury. Gaunt pitched the cadaver off the platform onto the ice, then grabbed hold of the smoldering, ruined weapon. There was a handle release to free the gun and its drums from the mount. He heaved on it, his hands slipping in thick grease. No human strength had tightened this latch. He put his weight behind it, cursing and grunting, expecting another round to explode in his face at any moment. The latch gave.
With a gasp and an effort that tore ligaments in his back and arms, he hefted the entire gun and ammo carriage off the metal bars of the mount frame and tipped it over off the vehicle. As it landed, three more rounds went off, one scudding across the surface of the ice in slithering jags like a phosphorescent sprite. Gaunt's gloves had caught fire from the red-hot metal, and he jerked them off, throwing them aside. He clambered forward onto the driver's position and tried to pull the driver's body out of the cockpit. Nearly 400 kilos of dead weight refused to budge. He looked back at Rawn, in time to see him finishing the fallen foot soldier with his blade. Gaunt yelled him over, his voice lost in the keening wind. Together they pried the driver's corpse free and flopped it into the ice. It had already begun to freeze and fell like a sack of rocks. Gaunt got into the cockpit, felt the space roomy and too big for a human operator. It stank of sweat and blood in the enclosed cabin. He tested the handlebar grips and found the foot pedals. His first tries at control revved the engine to a scream and then braked the sled in a jolt that threw the cursing Rawn onto his back in the troop bay behind him. Then he had the measure of it. It was a crude version of the land cars he had driven with his father back home years ago. There was a foot throttle and also a foot brake, though that did little but dig a massive spike down from the underside into the ice to retard motion. The anchor would only work in conjunction with de-throttling. With the engine racing, the spike would shatter and pull the guts out from under the motor sled. The gears, three of them, were set by a twist on the left handlebar grip. There were gauges on the crude dash calibrated in greenskin script, which he couldn't read or understand, but he began to measure the way the juddering needles spiked and dipped. "Hold on, Major," he warned, and raced them off towards the distant end of the valley. Rawn, in the back, clung on tight, the wind whipping his face and neck. Gaunt focused all his will into control. The massive machine bucked and jinked on every irregularity in the ice, but Gaunt quickly came to judge the way ahead and knew what conditions would skid them round, or slide them, or make them spin treads. There was no power assist to the steering, and he fought it. It was beyond his strength to keep the steering true, and he realized that he would never be able to drive the machine as fast as the stronger orcs could. It fought too much, and his strength was human, not inhuman. They rocked and bumped and jolted. More than once they spun out as he failed to keep the drive wheels true, and the back end came around in a flurry of ice shards. After the last such lapse, the raging engine stalled and refused to restart. There was a starter switch under the steering column, but it flopped slackly. Gaunt peered down and found the kickstart stirrup to the left of the brake. He bent and flopped it down, trying it with his boot. "Gaunt!" He looked up. Rawn was standing on the flatbed, pointing back. A kilometer away, three dark shapes were kicking up ice smoke as they raced after them. The orcs, with their superior strength and experience of the snow machines, were making better speed in their pursuit. Gaunt kicked viciously at the starter bar, time and again, until the engine yowled alive, and then hastily adjusted the protesting throttle. They spun again, fishtailed, then chugged away. Gaunt pushed the machine as fast as he thought he could control it. Another misread flaw in the ice, another spin-out, another stall, and they would be overrun, or overturned, necks snapped under the rolling tonnage of the motor sled. They came out of the night shadows of the valley onto the wide expanse of the ice floe. Sunlight seared them, and Gaunt and Rawn were blind for a moment, even after they pulled their glare goggles down. Ahead was the ice sea. White, scarlet, purple, green in patches, the ice was scalloped and curled like foam. Thousands of kilometers of open, frozen sea spread out to a horizon where it met the blackness of space. The sunlight was a hostile white menace. The sea and all its waves had frozen, as if in mid-ebb, and now the sled bounced and flew, rose and fell, across the dimpled peaks of breakers that had frozen a millennium before. The motor sled over-revved each time it left the ground and kicked ice chunks each time it landed. Gaunt could barely control the machine as the drive wheels and slithering skids kissed ice again. Rawn had thought about firing back at the orc machines closing on them, but the bumpy ride had thrown him to the greasy deck, and it was all he could do to cling on and lie flat. Face to the metal deck boarding, he saw the punctures for the first time.
shrapnel holes from the exploding bolter drums. There was a stink of oil rising from them. He crawled, hand over hand, to the tailgate as the sled jumped and crashed and saw a staining line of brown marking their wake. He turned and yelled, "We're bleeding fuel! The tank is punctured!" Gaunt cursed. Now he understood what one of the gauges, the one with the rapidly dipping needle, really meant. The orc pursuit was closing. Heavy bolter rounds and other explosive munitions rained down around them, blowing geysers of ice and steam up from the frozen sea. Gaunt realized his naked, gloveless hands were beginning to freeze solid around the steering grips. The pain brought tears to his eyes, tears which froze behind his goggles and blurred his vision, biting his cheeks. Two overshot projectiles from the orcs brought bigger explosions to the left of them. Sprays of glutinous, boiling liquid erupted far into the air from their impacts. Gaunt saw that the rushing landscape ahead of them was duller blue, more like frosted glass, cracked and crazed. They made the next rise, then the engine coughed, spluttered, died. They slid sideways in a long, wide deceleration, ice gouged up by Gaunt's desperate use of the anchor. He kicked the starter. The engine flared once, then died forever in a cough of stinking oil smoke. Dry rotors and cylinders burst and ground. The orc machines were 100 meters behind them. They could hear them whooping in victory. For the first time, Rawn realized that the wind was no longer screaming now they were out of the valley. Gaunt clambered out of the cockpit. "Tube charges, Rawn," he bawled. "What?" Gaunt pointed to where other wide shots from their pursuers dug steaming vents from the glassy ice. "The ice is thin here. We're riding over a thin skin. The living ocean is right below us." Another shot whinnied down and exploded the steering section of the sled where Gaunt had just been sitting. "Now!" Rawn understood the commissar's idea just as suddenly as he recognized the insanity of it. But the orcs were only 50 paces away. Rawn realized the desperation, too. He had 12 stick mines in his satchel, and he pulled them all out, handing half to Gaunt. He kicked the glass off one of the vehicle's lamps and used the white-hot filament to light the fuses. The two humans took 3 in each hand and hurled them as far and as hard as they could, scattering them wide. 12 huge explosions, each big enough to kill a tank. They split the world apart, but more particularly, they burst and shattered the ice. The steaming hydrocarbon sea, so close beneath, rushed up to plume and boil and froth in the air. One orc machine cartwheeled, an explosion taking it over. It tore itself and its occupants into fragments as it landed on ice that was beginning to separate and fracture in huge bobbing sections. Another dodged the rain of blasts and flew straight off the edge of an ice chunk into the sea, where it vaporized and burned. The last stopped short, the riders bellowing, just missing a gap in the ice. Then the ice chunk it sat on collapsed, and they all dropped, shrieking, into the frothing, flaming liquid. The ice was coming apart, fracturing into chunks that burned and steamed as the rising ocean, locked in for so many thousands of years, welled up and conquered the surface. On the back of their dead machine, Gaunt and Rawn leapt and yelled in triumph until they realized the ice collapse was spreading their way fast. The ocean fizzed and thrashed up around their sled runners, and the motor sled dipped suddenly. Gaunt jumped clear onto a nearby iceberg, newly formed and sizzling in the hideous liquid. He held out his hand. Rawn jumped after him, grabbing Gaunt's hand, allowing himself to be pulled clear as their ruined machine slid backwards into the liquid and exploded. "We can't stay here," Gaunt began. It was true. Their iceberg was rocking and dissolving like an ice cube in hot water. They leapt off it to the next, and then the next, hoping that the fractured sections of ice would remain intact long enough for them to reach some kind of shore. Vapors gasped and billowed around them. On the fourth, Rawn slipped, and Gaunt caught him just centimeters from the frothing water. They made the next flow, and Rawn moved ahead. He heard a cry behind him and turned to see the ice plate upending and Gaunt slipping backwards on his belly, clawing the surface as he slipped down towards the seething ocean of hydrocarbons. He could let him die. Rawn knew that. No one would know. No one would ever find the body. And even if they did. Besides, he couldn't reach him. Rawn pulled out his knife and hurled it. It stuck fast, blade down, in the tilting ice just above Gaunt's hand, and gave the commissar a grip.
Gaunt pulled himself up on the dagger, and then got his foot braced on it until he could reach up and take Rawn's hand. The Major hauled him up high enough for the pair to make a safe jump to the next berg. This was larger, more solid. They clung to it, side by side, panting and out of strength. The ice chunk behind them fell back into the ocean, taking Rawn's silver dagger with it. They sat together on top of the iceberg for 6 hours. Around them, the ocean refroze, and its seething hiss died away. But they could go nowhere. The reforming ice skin was but a few centimeters thick, thick enough to enclose the lethal liquid, but not so hard as to bear weight. The distress beacon from Gaunt's pack blinked and sighed behind them on the top of the ice chunk.
"I owe you,"
Gaunt said at last. Rawn shook his head. "I don't want that. You pulled me up there. Saved me. I owe you for that. And frankly, I'm surprised. I know you'd like to see me dead, and this was an opportunity that spared your hands from blood." Rawn turned to look at Gaunt, his face half lit by the dwindling starlight. His cheeks and chin seemed to catch the light more like a dagger now than ever before, and his eyes were hooded like a snake's. "One day I will kill you, Gaunt," he said simply. "I owe it to Tanith, to myself. But I'm no murderer, and I respect honor. You saved me from that greenskin in the cave, and so I owed you. I would do as much for any man in my command." "Precisely. You may think I'm a malcontent, but I stay loyal to the Emperor and the Guard, always. I owed you, and, though I hate myself for it, I repaid. Now we're even." "Even," Gaunt murmured, measuring the word softly in his mouth. "Or level, perhaps." Rawn smiled.
"The day will come, Ibram Gaunt, but it will be on equal terms, level terms, as you put it. I will kill you, and I will rejoice in it. But now is not the time."
"Thank you for being so forthright, Rawn."
Gaunt pulled out his Tanith knife, the knife given to him by Corbeck when they first mustered for war. Rawn tensed, jerking back. But Gaunt held it out to him, hilt first.
"You lost yours. I know any Tanith would be incomplete without a long blade at his hip."
Rawn took the knife. He held it in his hands for a second, spun it with deft fingers, and then slid it into his empty belt sheath.
"Do with it as you see fit," Gaunt said, turning his back on Rawn.
"I will, one of these days," replied Major Elim Rawn.
The infirmary lay well back from the main embankment defense here on Monthax. Like Gaunt's modular hut, it was raised out of the soupy ground on stacks. Long, swoop-roofed, the infirmary's wall planking was washed an arsenic green, while the roof was black with bitumen. Grey blast curtains protected the doors and window hatches, and bunches of pipes and cables carried in air from the scrubbers and power from the chattering turbine behind the place. Symbols of the Imperium and of the Medical Corps were stenciled on the walls, for all that Chaos would notice them if they stormed over the bulwark. Gaunt climbed up a metal ladder next to the rush ramp for stretcher parties and pushed inside through the screens and heavy curtaining. Inside he found a paradise and a surprise. It was by far the coolest and most fragrant place in the camp, probably the coolest, most fragrant place on Monthax itself. Sweet odors of sap rose from the fresh timber of the floor and the clean rush matting. There was a scent of antiseptic fluids, rubbing alcohol, and some purifying incense that burned in a bowl next to the small shrine set near the western end. The 40 beds were made up and empty. Pale, artificial light shone from gauze-hooded lamps. Gaunt wandered the length of the ward and let himself through a screen door at the end. There, access led off into storerooms, latrines, a small operating theatre, and the chief medical officer's quarters. Dawdon wasn't in his little tidy office, but Gaunt saw his distinctive handiwork in the careful arrangement of medical texts, chart folders, and the label front regimentation of the flasks and bottles in the locked dispensary cabinet. The medic was in the operating theatre, polishing the stainless steel surface and blood drains of the theatre table. Gleaming surgical tools, an autoclave and a resuscitrex unit sat in corners.
"Commissaire Gaunt,"
Dawdon looked up in surprise.
Can I help you?
As you were. Just a routine walkabout. Anything to report? Any problems? Dawdon stood up straight, balling the polishing cloth in his hands and dropping it into a ceramic bowl of disinfectant.
Not one, sir. Come to inspect the place.
Certainly an improvement on the last few facilities you've had to work with. Dawdon smiled. He was a small, elderly man with a trimmed grey beard and genial eyes that had seen more pain than they deserved.
It's empty yet.
I admit that surprised me when I came in. So used to seeing your places overflowing with wounded, Empress Barris.
Give it time, Dawdon said ominously. It unnerves me, I have to say. Seeing all those empty beds. I praise the Golden Throne, I'm idle, but idleness doesn't suit me. Must have polished and swept the place a dozen times already.
If that's the worst work you have here on Monthax, we may all give thanks.
May we all indeed. Can I offer you a cup of caffeine? I was about to light the stove.
Perhaps later, when I come back this way. I have to inspect the magazines. There are stirrings beyond us.
So I heard last night. Later then, sir.
Gaunt nodded and left. He doubted he'd have time to stop by later. And he doubted, too, that this little paradise would remain unsullied much longer. Dawdon watched the commissar leave and stood for a while longer, surveying the clean ward with its empty cots. Like Gaunt, he had no illusions as to the horror hole this place would become. It was inevitable. He closed his eyes, and for a moment he could see the floor matting drenched in black blood, the soiled sheets, the moaning, screaming faces, and the silent ones. His nostrils seemed to detect blood and burned flesh for a second, but it was just the incense. Just the incense. Part 8. Blood Oath. The fallen men, scattered on the roadway and across the low, muddy fields of Nacedon, looked like they were wearing black mail armor, but they weren't. The meat flies were busy. They covered the flesh like seething black links of armor. They glittered furiously, moving like a single thing.
Medic!
Tollin Dawdon looked away from the flies. The afternoon sky lay wide and misty over the low, flat fens. Trackways and field boundaries were marked with dikes and hedgeways, all of them ruined and overrun with razor posts, concertina wire, and churned tank paths. The mist smelled of thermite powder.
Medic!
The call again, sharp and insistent, from down the roadway. Slowly, Dawdon turned and trudged from the gutter of the road where, for 100 meters, more corpses lay twisted and crumpled and coated in flies. He advanced towards the buildings. Feth that he'd seen enough of this war now, no matter what the world. He was tired, and he was spent. 60 years old, older by 20 years than any of the other ghosts. He was weary, weary of the death, the fighting, weary of the young bodies he had to patch back together. Weary, too, of being regarded as a father by so many men who had lost their own at the fall of Tanith. Smoke clogged the late afternoon sky across the low fields. He approached the old red brick buildings with their blown-out windows and crumpled walls. It had been a farm complex once, before the invasion. A feudal estate with a main house, outbuildings, and barns. Agricultural machinery lay rusting and broken in waterlogged swine pens. A wide trench gully and a double fence of seared flakboards, topped with more spools of wire, enclosed the complex in a horseshoe, with the northern side, the one that faced away from the front line, open. Ghosts stood point all around, weapons ready. Trooper Brostin nodded him inside. Dawdon passed a sandbagged gunnery post from which the weapon had been hastily removed and entered the first of the buildings, the main house, through a doorway that had been shot out of the brick by sustained lasfire. More flies billowing in clouds in the afternoon sunlight. The smell of death he was so used to. And other smells, antiseptic, blood, waste. Dawdon stepped across a tiled floor. Half the tiles were broken, littered with glass and pools of oil that shimmered rainbow colors. Korbeck loomed out of the shadows nearby, shaking his weary head.
Doc, he acknowledged. Colonel.
Field hospital, Korbeck said, gesturing around himself. Dawdon already knew as much.
Anyone alive?
That's why I called for you.
Korbeck led him through to a vaulted hallway.
The various stenches were stronger in here. Perhaps 5 dozen men lay on pallet beds in the chamber, half lit by pallid yellow sunlight that streaked down through shattered lights in the sloping roof. Dawdon walked the length of the room and then back.
"Why have they been left here?" he asked.
Corbeck shot him a questioning look.
"Why do you think? We're all retreating. Too much to carry. Can you sort them?"
Dawdon cursed quietly.
"These men are what?"
"Blue Bloods, Volpone 50th. You remember those devils from Voltimand? Their command units pulled out this morning, as per orders."
"And they left the wounded here?"
Corbeck shrugged.
"Seems so, Doc."
"What kind of animal leaves his sick and wounded behind to die?"
Dawdon spat, moving to change the dressings on the nearest man.
"The human kind?"
Corbeck asked.
Dawdon looked round sharply.
"This isn't funny, Corbeck. It's not even whimsical. Most of these men will live with the proper attention. We're not leaving them."
Corbeck groaned softly. He rubbed the top of his scalp, folding the thick black hair between his big, swarthy fingers.
"We can't stay here, Doc. Commissar's orders."
Dawdon turned and looked at the colonel with fierce, old eyes.
"I'm not leaving them," he stated plainly.
Corbeck seemed to start to say something, then hesitated, and decided better of it.
"See what you can do for them," he said,
and left Dawdon to his work. Dawdon was treating a leg wound when he heard the crunch of gravel on the roadway outside and the rumble of a troop carrier. He looked up to locate the source of the sound only after he had finished what he was doing.
"Thank you, sir,"
said the young man whose leg he had treated. The boy was pale and sallow, too weak to rise from his pallet bed.
"What's your name?"
Dawdon asked.
"Calchas, sir. Trooper. Blue Blood."
Dawdon was sure that Calchas would have wanted to punctuate that statement with an exclamation mark, but he was too weak to manage it.
"I'm Dawdon, medic, Tanith."
"You need me, Trooper Calchas. You call my name."
The boy nodded. Dawdon went outside, approaching the chimera parked below the leaning walls. Corbeck was speaking to the tall figure perched on top. The figure moved, dropped down to the soil, began to march towards him. Gaunt, his cap on, his face a shadow, his long coat flying.
"Sir,"
Dawdon said.
"Dawdon, Corbeck says you won't move."
68 wounded here, sir. Can't leave them. Won't leave them."
Gaunt took Dawdon's arm and led him across the muddy yard to the side wall that looked out across trampled farmland and vacant swine pens towards the setting suns beyond.
"You must, Dawdon. Enemy forces are half a day behind us. General Muller has called us all to retreat. We can't carry them with us. I'm sorry."
Dawdon shook off the commissar's grip.
"So am I," he said.
Gaunt turned away. For a moment, Dawdon thought the commissar might round on him and discipline him with a fist. But he didn't. Instead, the man sighed. On reflection, Dawdon knew violence wasn't Gaunt's first or chosen way of command. The endless war and his experience of other officer cadres in the field had soured Dawdon's expectation, something he wasn't proud of. Gaunt looked back at the medic.
"Corbeck told me you'd say as much. Look, the counterpush for Nasadon is scheduled for tomorrow night. Then, and only then, Emperor willing, we'll retake this land and drive the enemy back.
Few of them will last the night and day unattended, and none of it if they are found and attended by the chaos filth."
Gaunt took off his cap and smoothed his cropped blonde hair. The dying sun's light silhouetted his angular profile, but kept his internal thoughts in shadow.
"You have my respect, medic.
You've always had it, since the founding fields even. The only ghost who refused to bear arms, the only man who can keep us alive. The ghosts owe you. Many of them owe you their lives. I owe you for that.
I'd hate to have to give you an order."
"Then don't, Commissar. You know I'll refuse it. I'm a medic first and a ghost second. Back on Tanith, as a community practitioner, I worked for 30 years ministering to the sick, the infirm, the newborn and the weak in the Beldane district and County Prize. I did it because I took an oath at the medical college in Tanith Magna. You understand allegiances and oaths, Commissar? Understand mine?"
"I understand the weight of the medical oath well enough."
"And you've honored it. Never asked me to break my vow and confidentiality over men with private problems. Drink, pox, mind troubles. You've always let me do as my oath bids. Let me now.
Gaunt replaced his cap.
I can't leave you here to die. But you'd leave these men to die. They're not the ghost's chief medic.
Gaunt spat the answer and then fell silent.
A doctor is vowed to serve any injured. Oh, I swore to the Emperor on the founding fields to serve him and you and the Imperial Guard, but had already sworn to the Emperor to uphold life. Don't make me break that vow.
Gaunt tried logic. Our illustrious forces were routed on the Delta at Lohenic. We are fleeing before a massed chaos army that thunders at our heels, barely half a day away. You are a non-combatant. How could you hold this place?
With words, if I have to. With volunteers, if any will stay, and you'll allow it. After all, it's only until tomorrow night. Until your counter-push retakes this place. Or was that a lie? Propaganda.
Gaunt said nothing for a while, tilting his tall bulk into the evening suns, adjusting his muddy coat. Then he turned back to the old medic. No lie. We will retake this land and beyond. We will drive them back as they come to us.
But to leave you out here, even for a night, don't think of me. Think of the Volponi wounded in there.
Gaunt did. It didn't change his mind much.
They would have had us butchered. Don't go to that place, Dorden warned. Hate has no place between allies.